This is Climate Justice, Y'all, a podcast dedicated to lifting up and centering the climate and environmental justice movement in the South. Despite the South being the most biodiverse, diverse, and one of the largest economic engines in the world, we are underfunded and often barred from the decision-making table. Because of that, we decide to pull up a chair and amplify the stories of communities in the South hit the hardest by the climate crisis.
We're using good old-fashioned storytelling to shine a spotlight on these Southern leaders from all walks of life, putting in their blood, sweat, and tears to transform the region. The usage of y'all in the title is on purpose. We are honoring our Southern heritage of creativity, resilience, and ingenuity.
All right, y'all, it is season two of Climate Justice, Y'all. Let's get started. Hey, y'all, I'm your host, Abigail Franks, and I am joined by the fabulous Marisha Malcolm. Even though everything seems more chaotic and violent than ever before, whether it be racism, shootings, environmental injustice, climate change, the list goes on, we must recognize that we are standing on the shoulders of generations of activists who have fought to make this world a better place. In fact, the South is the cornucopia of legendary activists. We're joined by the legendary Catherine Coleman Flowers, whose list of titles is extensive and who has been fighting for civil rights and environmental justice since she was a high schooler in Lowndes County. Today, we discuss her experiences, the lessons that she has learned, and the need for a holistic approach to justice and policy.
Climate justice, y'all. It's real, it's here, and it's about time we listen to folks like Miss Catherine Coleman Flowers. All right, let's get started with the show.
All right. Good morning. Today, we have the fabulous, the legend herself, Catherine Coleman Flowers. Miss Catherine, I know you told me I can call you Catherine, but I'll probably keep saying Miss Catherine until it gets out of me because I'm Southern. But could you introduce yourself and the organizations that you work with and stuff?
Yes, I appreciate Southern because I'm Southern too. My name is Catherine Coleman Flowers. I'm the founding director of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. I'm also a board member for the Climate Reality Project and the Natural Resource Defense Council, and recently the Center for Constitutional Rights. I also serve on the board of advisors for the JPB Foundation as well. My work has centered around environmental and climate justice. And I'm fortunate to be able to constantly expand and work with various groups and universities across the country to try to work on long-term solutions. And more recently, I just re-upped my role as a participant, I just re-upped my role at Duke University, where I'll be serving there, working with students at the Nicholas School, dealing with environmental science and environmental justice.
That's amazing. And that doesn't even begin to really talk about everything that you've accomplished over the years and everything, and just all the work that you've done. And so I would love to talk more about that a little bit. So like in your book, Waste, One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret, which I love, by the way, it's on my bookshelf right now. I just finished reading it. But you talk about your journey of activism since you were a kid, dealing with civil rights issues, to education issues, to environmental justice. So could you talk more about like some of your highlights of your activism over the years? What has your experience been like? Those kinds of things. I know that's a broad question. So anything.
Yes, that is a broad question because my years of activism goes back to high school. I was fortunate to have parents that were also activists. And I think I learned a lot from them by attending all those meetings or sitting around listening to people that came to visit to talk to them about strategies and what was happening during that particular time period. But my activism in earnest started in high school when I worked to get rid of the principal to improve our education. A lot of the things that we talk about now, as we talk about the Me Too generation, were very much a part of my childhood. We didn't call it Me Too then, but the kind of harassment that took place from some of the men at the high school was accepted. But also the fact that they were taking resources from our school, putting it into the private school, we were able to stop that and change the name of my school. I think one of the highlights was changing the name from Lowndes County Training School to Central High School, which was when I graduated from high school. I didn't have that stigma that was attached to that name, training school, which they put on a lot of Black schools in the South. And then, of course, later, another highlight was being an activist at Alabama State University, where I spent some time, where I went to school initially, and I became I helped to organize a march to save the university, because there was a move underway to merge all of the Black state HBCUs. And this particular case, they were going to merge Alabama State University under the Auburn University of Montgomery, which had come along second. And was more recent, instead of it being the other way around. And I was one of the first student plaintiffs in the ninth case that challenged that, and we won. From that point, in North Carolina, there were several milestones. In North Carolina, I ended up filing a civil rights complaint on behalf of students at Hull County High School because they were being mistreated. And I filed this Title VI complaint with the U.S. Department of Education, and I was told that was the first time a teacher ever filed a complaint on behalf of students instead of the other way, usually they're filing complaints on behalf of themselves. And of course, the work that I've done around sanitation in Lowndes County, which has opened the door and pulled the screen back on what I do call America's Dirty Secret, because there are so many communities that are grappling, especially rural communities, grappling with not having any working sewer or sanitation infrastructure. And then, of course, I'm hearing now from urban areas. Like, I talked to people in Houston yesterday. I've been to Mount Vernon, New York, and other areas where people are also experiencing the same problem. So that's where we have the intersection of climate change and environmental justice, that as we build to build for resilience and sustainability, we have to make sure that those communities that have been left behind and under-resourced get what they need. And that's, those are kind of like the highlights of my activism as I see it.
Yeah, and you really are the definition of a holistic activist, because it seems like from what you've said in the past and what you just said now, that like part of activism is understanding that you have to deal with a lot of systemic issues at once rather than just focusing on one sector. You know what I mean?
Yes, because otherwise they continue to manifest.
Exactly.
And sometimes we're well-intentioned with our approach, but sometimes our approaches have helped these structural issues to manifest and to continue over these years. So we have to change the way we look at them, and we also have to change the approach.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So kind of in that same vein, what are some lessons that you've learned through your activism? Like how do these lessons apply to your work now? Because you mentioned earlier all the work that you're doing. You're also, if I'm not mistaken, with the White House Environmental Justice
Advisory Council.
Yeah. 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 So what lessons have you learned with your experience, and how do they apply to your work now?
Well, I've learned that this is a marathon and not a sprint. So I learned that we have to be able to know what victory looks like. And sometimes we don't know what victory looks like. And sometimes the victory has to take place in phases. I've learned that. I've also learned that we won't get anywhere if we don't talk to each other. And as long as we decide that if we silo ourselves and we don't collaborate, and we don't talk to each other. And sometimes we have to talk to people that are on the opposing side and see what we have in common, and if we can find some common ground. So those are things that I've learned in terms of how do we get to success? Because at the end of the day, all of these issues that we're fighting to change impact all of us ultimately, because climate change doesn't care what race, your zip code, or whatever. At the end of the day, Earth is our common home, and we all have the same thing at stake, whether or not we're going to leave a planet or destroy this planet and its ability to be able to sustain life as we know it. So we have to find that common ground to get to where we can have a healthy planet to protect all of us and the generations to come.
Wow. That was very insightful. I just have one question, because I'm not familiar with being the leader in like an activism movement and whatnot. I just want to know, what is that like, leading people in this fight, even maybe not even leading them, but just being such a heroic Black woman in this fight. What is that like?
You know, I really don't see myself that way. I see myself more as a teacher and a listener. And part of the learning experience is being able to listen. You know, one, I remember a paradigm. I used to be a teacher. I used to be a classroom teacher. And one of the things about learning, what learning is when you can communicate a thought or an idea to someone or a fact, and they can deliver it back to you. And part of that is listening. Listening is a very important skill. So I don't think that I would have done any of the things that I've been able to accomplish without listening to other people, whether it was my students when I was teaching in the classroom, who pushed and encouraged me to go beyond the classroom and to stretch myself, or whether it's sitting on Ms. Shue's porch, listening to her talk about the civil rights movement, or listening to my parents, or listening to the people in Lowndes County who told me that they were having problems with wastewater issues that were not what the health department was saying. So I had to listen to them. And basically, by listening to them, it helped me to reach out and find the people that I needed to partner with to either prove or disprove what we had been told. So I think that the most important thing that we have to learn in leadership is that we can't lead people if we don't listen to them. And then the second thing is we have to be willing to change when we're wrong and acknowledge that. That's okay, that's a learning experience, because sometimes we're gonna make mistakes. And I think that the other thing that's important is that we have to remain humble. And being from the South, we know that being humble doesn't mean that you're not strong. It means that we have to sometimes defer to other people. And what I do oftentimes when I go back to Lowndes County, I'm Catherine Colvin Flowers from the 4-5. You know, I'm still a country girl. So it doesn't matter whether I'm in the White House or still using the outhouse, I still have to be able to relate to where I'm from and be able to be comfortable talking to everybody and have them be comfortable talking to me. So I think those are the important things that you have to learn in terms of leadership. And what I always do is realize that I would not be where I am were it not for the other people that are holding me up. And I never forget that.
Yeah, I thank you for that. I love, first of all, the quote that you just said about whether it be the White House or the outhouse. That needs to be sewn on a pillow or something, or cross stitch or something. That's perfect. You know what I mean? Like, but I mean, so thank you for all of this. And I just want to be candid here. I resonated a lot with the realities of Alabama that you've highlighted through your different talks, your documentaries, and your book, especially about the lack of basic infrastructure, like our terrible sewage systems and stuff. Where I grew up, we were on septic tanks, and I grew up in a really, really rural area that it could be considered a trailer park if they were close enough together, you know what I mean? But there was sewage in the front yard, and I thought that it was a poor trailer trash problem and not a systemic issue. And so could you talk more about this issue that plagues Alabama and probably other places in the country too? And because I kind of want to normalize this a little bit, because I think if we talk about it, we can talk more about the solutions to implement, that we could implement to alleviate these problems. You know what I mean?
Well, first of all, these are problems throughout the United States. I mean, one of the things I found when I first started doing this work, I didn't realize how prevalent septic tanks are. You know, there are septic tanks in Fulton County, Georgia. There are septic tanks in Miami, in the Miami area. They've actually built subdivisions using septic tanks. There's septic tanks in Montgomery, Alabama, you know, the capital city, where, and there, I think in terms of systemic racism, you're only going to find them primarily in Black communities, and some of them are middle-class communities, and they're within 600 feet of a sewer line. So, and they're paying wastewater fees as well as water fees, but they don't get the services. And we're finding out that septic tanks are failing as they are currently designed. And they are primarily sold to, I've even noticed when I moved, I think I mentioned at the beginning when we were talking before the podcast, is that I moved to North Alabama. When I was looking for a house, I found out that the value of a house was diminished if they were on a septic tank versus a public sewer system. So it's a problem that occurs throughout the U.S. What we found in Lowndes County and places like Lowndes County, especially in poorer communities, that these systems are more likely to fail in a lot of these areas because poorer people generally are not sold the best land or the water tables are very high. So these systems fail, and when they fail, they thought it was a personal failing. It wasn't a personal failing, it was a systemic failing because these systems have been allowed to be developed and sold to folks, knowing that their lifespan is very short, knowing that as we deal with climate change and sea level rise, these systems are going to fail even more, knowing that poor people are going to live in the swampier part of the community because that's what they can afford and that's what's going to be sold to them. So all of these things are factors in this. And I think that we can't also accept and normalize that it's okay for rural communities not to get working infrastructure. We cannot normalize that. And that's what we've done. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we pull the cover off of that to reveal that rural communities, because most of the United States is rural, it's not urban. Most people live in urban areas. You just got a whole lot of people in a small area. But if you look at the entire country from sea to shining sea, most of it is rural. And we're going to have to deal with these infrastructure issues because people are going to have to move from these coastal areas where a lot of our cities are. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to move because of sea level rise and climate change. And where are they going to move? Have we even invested in what we need to do to put this infrastructure in place? And what happens with a septic tank, in most cases, especially in Alabama, once it's put in on your property, the liability is transferred to the homeowner. Yep. So the manufacturers have no liability whatsoever. If they fail, it's your problem. It's not their problem. And I'm advocating for at least having a warranty on a septic tank as long as a warranty is on a roof. If you can get a 30-year shingle roof, why can't we get a 30-year septic tank? Because the septic system, in terms of our health, if they fail, it exposes the family to a lot of health issues. Where if the roof fails, it just messes up your house, definitely. But a septic tank is just as important. And I think we need to change the way we look at it. And that'll help us change the way it's designed.
So you spoke on like the warranty for a septic tank. What are other ways that you and the legislators that you work with are working to better like the septic tank and like not get rid of it, but just, you know, better it, fix it?
Well, I'm not really working with legislators on this. I don't think that this is a legislative issue. I've asked organizations that I work with to push for warranties that if any government money is used to put in place septic tanks, why use taxpayers' money to put in place something you know is going to fail within 5 years or 2 years? Mm-hmm. That's a disgrace. And it also exposes these families again, because once that money is spent, they're stuck. It'll be generations before that will ever happen again. And when they fail, it comes back into people's homes. So what we're pushing for ways in which to develop something that works. And that's what we've been working on. And I'm not at liberty to reveal that yet, but we're going to announce some of the things that we're doing and some of the partners that we're working with to change the way, the whole paradigm in terms of how these systems are designed and how they work. Because it's not just the septic tanks that are failing. I was in Mount Vernon, New York. I was called there last year in July. And when I went there, people had sewage running back into their homes and had been doing that for over 20 years. And some of these homes were priced at $1 million because of their proximity. They're in Westchester County, one of the richest counties in the U.S., but Mount Vernon is Black. And it's also in terms of its proximity to New York City. And we found that this has been happening for years, but it's because the clay pipes or 100 years old. They're at least 100 feet underground. They don't even know where a lot of them are. And they have explosions sometimes where sewage just comes out of the main. And the workers there have had numerous cases where it's just blowing up in their faces. And they have to fumigate their cars at least once a week. Because, and they going home wondering whether or not they're taking diseases home to their young children. Because they're out there, these are the public works people, these are young men with families. But they're committed to finding solutions. And because we expose this, one thing I can say about the governor of New York is that she's now given the town of Mount Vernon $150 million to fix the problem. And so we have to, first of all, make sure that where there are solutions that we can get them. And everybody doesn't need to be on the septic tank. Like the people in Montgomery, Alabama, when you're within 600 feet of a sewer main and you're paying a wastewater fee, need to be connected to the system that does work. We have to, and we look at Whitehall, Alabama in Lowndes County, a solution is putting a treatment plant there. It seemed to be acceptable to put sewage lagoons on the campuses of poor black campuses where they service black children, or to put them in places where poor people are located. We need to change that thinking and not accept that. That's one of the solutions. And the other solution is to make sure that the technologies that are available that do work, that we can't say that we're not gonna put them there because it costs too much. What is the cost in terms of a disease that can manifest right here in the United States, like COVID, and end up killing all of us versus making sure that people are all healthy and have access to sanitation and quality? I don't think that there's a cost that's too great to do that.
And there shouldn't be. I mean, it's all about whether or not we value human lives or not and human quality of life. You've briefly briefly touched on the intersectionality of like racism, of environmental health, of climate change. Could you talk more about like what? How do I put this question? I got too excited and I often talk before I think. So what I'm trying to say is that a lot of folks, especially in Alabama, myself included, didn't realize that they lived in an environmental justice community or in a community that's impacted by climate change. Like they just don't realize. Could you talk more about what environmental injustice looks like in Alabama? So maybe there are listeners that may relate to this and it may give them a reason to advocate and such. I don't know if any of that makes sense.
Yeah, so it manifests in different ways. It manifests if you're living near a polluting plant and the people in your community are having illnesses that they can't, that they cannot identify the source. And generally it's because of pollution. I mean, North Birmingham is a good example of that. Because of the asthma rates that are there and other issues. I had a cousin to reach out to me. She lives in Las Vegas. And she told me about her aunt who had bought a house in Birmingham. And she said her aunt has been sick ever since she moved into the house. So I asked her for the address. And I went and looked it up and I found out that it was near a place that is near a Superfund site that was never disclosed to her before she purchased the house. And then they realized that's why she was sick.
Oh, good grief.
It means living in a community that may have a coal-fired furnace. It means living in a community where you have raw sewage on the ground. You know, whether it's just your trailer, whether it's in a trailer park or it's off by itself. That's an environmental justice issue. You know, those are just different ways in which it manifests. It's Uniontown, which is the poster child for environmental justice issues, where they have lots of issues going on in Uniontown, including a coal, a landfill that was bringing coal ash from a place in Tennessee. So it manifests itself in different ways. That polluting plant that's sitting on the river and dumping stuff into the river, it not only kills the wildlife there and the seafood, but it also has an impact on the health of the people in the region. So all of those are environmental justice issues. If you're living near a highway, you know, a lot of people don't know. In my home, I have an air quality monitor. And with this air quality monitor, p- people don't understand that if you're living near a highway, you're more likely to have health issues because of that. And that tends to happen in a lot of poor communities or communities of color. Another issue that people don't know about, you know, and this is Catherine talking now, but I think if you're forced to get a gas stove, children that live in households that have gas tend to have more respiratory issues than those that don't. So if there's some places where you live where you don't have a choice, especially even if it's a new home, they're saying you don't have a choice. You can swap it out later, but then there are all those issues around fossil fuels and being exposed to the health issues that it can cause. And to me, that's what environmental justice looks like, or environmental injustice looks like.
Right. So what are ways for the locals and the community members to get involved in like advocating for themselves, for their community, for their neighborhood? And if so, can they get involved with you and some of the work that you do?
Well, what I try to do, you know, there are so many different groups out there, like, you know, like the group that Reverend Malcolm runs. There's so many different groups, or GASP, Michael Hansen runs. There's so many different groups that are out there. So what I try to do when people reach out to me, because we collaborate, I try to connect them to people in their particular areas that are dealing with their problems. Yesterday, I had people call me from Houston, Texas. So I'm connecting them with environmental justice advocates in Houston, Texas, to help them solve their problems. And whatever we can do to help them on the research side, connecting them with researchers, or even going in and providing training for people on the ground on how to do the research to verify, because oftentimes people pretend like it doesn't exist if there's no evidence. They were only interested in what was happening with us around, they were only interested in what was happening with us around wastewater when we were able to prove that people had hookworm and other tropical parasites related to exposure. You know, when we brought the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty to Lowndes County to see that, and it became kind of one of the hallmarks of his report when he reported it on it in Geneva. I think that those are the kinds of things that we can help local communities do. One of the principles of environmental justice that I've learned that's very, very important, but it's also very important to organize, is that the local people have to speak for themselves. So if they need help from us providing them with the support to lift up their voices, we do that as well. If someone has a story they want to tell and the media is not paying them any attention, we try to use our access to open the door for them to be able to tell those stories and to get the attention and propose the solutions to the problems that they're dealing with.
So, Ms. Catherine, before we wrap this good old episode up, we just have one question for you, and that's what gives you hope? What gives you hope to keep going? What gives you hope to keep advocating for this good old fight? What gives you hope?
Well, what gives me hope is all the other people that are out there fighting, and I'm mostly inspired by young people. When I went to Scotland, I went to a TED event that was a countdown to COP26. And the young people kept it real. And I'm very inspired by that. I'm inspired by, yesterday I met with a group of young people from West Point, the military academy. And they were talking about climate change and environmental justice. That's what gives me hope. Because I know that when I can no longer fight this fight, that there are so many other people to take my place. And there's so many young people that's gonna make sure that we can provide for generations to come. And that's what gives me hope.